CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 128, with Dr. Victor Kopras, the keys to developing a large eye institute from scratch over the decades.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today, I have a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. Victor Kopras from the Philippines, from Manila. Victor, thank you for coming to our podcast.
Thanks, today. I'm really happy to be here. Yeah, I don't usually come on podcasts. In fact, this is my first time. And I'm really thrilled.
We're just going to have a fun discussion. So I actually recently came to visit you. Thank you for a very kind invitation. So you put on a beautiful seminar for the Eye and Vision Institute in the medical city there in Manila. And I really had a fantastic time visiting you and all your residents in Manila. Tell me about your program. Tell me about the Eye and Vision Institute and tell me about the medical city and how you started all this.
Okay. I've been in the medical city for about 35 years.
Wow.
And when I got in, they didn't have a department of ophthalmology yet. So that started about 5 years after I got there. And believe it or not, we started from just a single room with a few instruments, a nurse to man the clinic, and one resident. And now we've graduated, I think, about 60 residents, and we graduate 3 a year. And it has grown from sharing an OR with surgery. We now have 5 ORs, 3 main ORs, 1 LASIK OR, and 1 minor OR, and fully equipped. We even have a dry eye clinic. We have a teleophthalmology program going. We have 5 fellowship programs going. So it's grown. I took the chair in 2007, believe it or not. This is my 18th year.
Wow, and it's been
an adventure. A little difficult. You know, we live for the challenges, right?
No, for sure. So, you know, back when you did your training, you trained in the Philippines, but then you also did a fellowship at Harvard and also did a master in public health at Harvard.
Yes.
Did you ever think you're going to grow into such a huge program?
No, I never. I wasn't even part of the hospital when I left. I had just come out of residency. I took my first fellowship at the Philippine General Hospital in Cornea. And then that was 2 years, and then left again for another 18 months. I was a research fellow at the Scapens Eye Research Institute. And while I was there, as if I was not busy enough, I said, hey, why not? You know, they were offering a 1 year master in public health. And I'll give you a little background on that. Why public health? Because, I don't know, I think I have a lot of my father in me. My father was an ophthalmologist. Okay. In fact, he was a pioneer. He was the first Filipino to have trained solely in ophthalmology. Remember, there used to be a ear, nose, eye, ear, nose, and throat?
E-E-N-T.
That's right. So he was the first just plain ophthalmology. And he was the first Filipino fellow of the American College of Surgery for ophthalmology. Now, he had a good practice, but you know, his love was, he conducted over his career more than 3,000 missions to remote areas in the islands. And he operated on more than 20,000, all for free. And this was like intracapsular. Just like the old Indian eye camps,
right?
Yeah. So, and one summer between my first and second year of high school, he took me along on one of the trips, and I remember it so well because he took me down south, and one of the places where we went, there was a war going on. You know, there's this separatist movement that was very active in the 70s over in Mindanao. And there was a shooting war, and we were right in the middle of it. And the hospital where we were sleeping in, there was a firefight right outside the walls. And I remember that so well. But what really stuck with me was, you know, seeing my dad help these people and, you know, going all, bringing everything. He was bringing everything, and he was operating with just one nurse. And I was actually there to sort of clean up and help them out. And after that summer, I was hooked. And when I entered med school, I never entertained any other specialty except ophthalmology.
So, wow.
Yeah. And so public health was a natural thing for me.
No, absolutely, for sure. That's an incredible experience at a very young age.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell you what, when I was like a senior in high school, we actually operated on a dining table, and he made me scrub and he nucleated somebody's eye and he made me scrub. And I did get freaked out. I actually liked it. So, you know, it was a natural for me.
Wow, that's just amazing. The neat part too is now you're giving back in the same way. You're teaching the whole next generation of ophthalmologists.
Well, I like to think that in our small way, we're just one program out of many. And, you know, Philippine ophthalmology has grown leaps and bounds in my whole lifetime, in my whole career. And there are very good programs. And you saw it. You saw how the quality of the residents and the quality of the doctors. What's the paradox is we have such good talent and we also have some equipment, but it doesn't reach many people. And the distribution of ophthalmologists around the country, the paradox there is we actually reach WHO levels of ophthalmologists per population. We even exceed the UK in terms of number of ophthalmologists per million population.
Wow.
The problem is they're all in Manila.
Oh.
Like more than 50% are in Manila, and only 15% of cities and towns in the Philippines have an ophthalmologist. Now, down south in Mindanao, there's only one or two ophthalmologists per million people. And that's a big problem. That's a real big problem.
Right.
And because, you know, our health department, our government has other priorities, of course. I mean, eye blindness, although it has its own program, doesn't even have its own budget. So it's difficult. It's difficult. So it's really the private sector has to really pitch in, and in our little way, you know, at the hospital, we're doing that. I'm lucky enough to be part of an enterprise where there are several hospitals around the islands, and right. We're hoping that we can, you know, send our graduates to these places. We have done so to a small degree already, but. The hope is that we can fill these hospitals with specialists which are needed. You know, like most people are GPs. We only have maybe 300, 400 specialists in the country. And the great number would be in Manila or Cebu or the big cities there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a big problem, but, you know, it was worse before, so we're making some progress.
Yeah, for our listeners who don't know, I mean, Manila is a huge city, bigger than Los Angeles,
yep.
For sure.
And yes, I have.
And worse traffic than Los Angeles, too, let me tell you that.
Yeah, we're world class.
Absolutely, beautiful city. But you're right, the Philippines is like probably 10,000 islands.
More like 7,700.
Okay. Yeah. So it's like 7,700 islands. I visited a few of them. Boracay, El Nido, Palawan. I had a beautiful time.
Yeah, you went to the nicest places.
Right, they were beautiful. But I think you're right. I mean, so you have so many islands that just don't have an ophthalmologist.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Many of those islands aren't populated. Some of them are really too small, but... You know, Mindanao is very, very big island. I think it's even bigger. It's almost the size of Luzon. And we only have about one or two ophthalmologists per million there.
That's
especially in the areas where there's some conflict. There's hardly any ophthalmologists. So, and that's just one problem, you know, the physical accessibility. The second is financial. I mean, they if they can find an ophthalmologist and if they can manage to get there, they can't pay them. Right. Because most ophthalmologists are private practitioners. There's hardly any government service. And if you have an ophthalmologist in a hospital, it's probably part-time, or maybe it's underserved, it's under-equipped. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot of work to be done there.
Right, and especially, I noticed one thing among your residents, which is they're obviously very well trained, but they do a huge number of brunescent cataract, white cataract. It seems like the normal for them is a brunescent or white cataract. I don't think there's like almost no patients with 2+ nuclear sclerosis.
We still call them California cataracts, by the way, when they're less than 4+. Anyway, yeah, that's true. And it's because people put off having surgery because they can't pay. But recently, the government increased the benefits through the National Health Insurance. So, you know, we're seeing more and more come earlier for cataract and other problems.
Right. I mean, your residents were really fantastic, but I think almost 100% of cases they showed were brunescent, dense like rocks, white cataracts. I was like, wow, you guys got a lot of dense cataracts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, you should come over. We'll give you some.
Yeah. I mean, the skill level is immense. So how do you start? Here's the big question. How do you start training a resident with such difficult cases? There are no easy cases to start with.
Okay. We try as we start them off in their second year doing ECCE.
Okay.
And that's where they get the real rocks. Because anything less dense than that, we do phaco on. So, you know, we break them in, and once they get into their third year, we start with the basics. You know, we go step by step. Mm-hmm. So you master the incision, you master the rexis, and then you master the, you know, learn the phaco dynamics, and, you know, until you can complete one case. And in our institution, it's the law. I mean, I made it a rule that no resident can operate without a consultant beside you. I mean, at the start, the consultant scrubs in when they're a little more comfortable. They're just around there to advise, but none of them operate without a consultant there. You know, and it's like a reaction I had, because when I trained, we were just left to our own devices, you know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you just go ahead. And I was lucky that I had very good seniors who taught me properly. And we were able to manage without much problems. But I found that it was a little bit, you know, hairy and a little bit unethical to just throw people like that in and learn from their mistakes. And then, you know, it did feel right that you should be learning from what happens to other people, you know. So
right.
Yeah, so that's how we teach them. And because of the number of cases that they're able to do, they pick up very quickly.
The skill level was, I mean, fantastic. I was amazed. I was one of the judges for the video contest for both residents and consultants, and those cases were unbelievably good.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thank you. They also chose the best ones to show you, right?
Of course. But you obviously set a very high bar then. So for your residents and your fellows, you have a very high expectations.
Oh, yeah. We do. In fact, I think we're the only institution that started a advanced cataract fellowship. It's a combined refractive and advanced cataract fellowship. And she actually showed a case. She won, I think, the second prize in the video contest. And that's the level of expertise we want to achieve. You know, I mean, they watch cataract coach all the time, and they learn a lot from that. Yeah, but
we all learn together for sure.
Yeah. So I wanted them to be exposed to, you know, multifocal lenses, toric lens, all the premium lenses, the diagnostics, and so I think we can be better than just doing plain phaco. And you know, doing mass surgeries, we can start doing refractive lens exchanges and other stuff. And we do a lot of clinical trials as well already, especially on the new IOLs.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, the enthusiasm level for your residents is very, very high. So it must be a very competitive residency and very competitive fellowship. You must get a tremendous number of applicants for those few spots.
Yeah. The whole Philippines, there's only about 120, 130 slots.
Wow.
For residency, for first year residency. And for fellowships, I think there's only like 50 or 60 slots for fellowships, the whole country. So it's really a lot of graduates actually have to leave they go to Singapore, they go to the US, some go to Europe to get their fellowships. So it's tough, and I feel sad for them, because these are talented people. They're also very young and ambitious, and we can't accommodate them. I usually start out in the application period giving a short speech to the applicants and say, you know, I'm very sorry that we can't take all of you. I know you're all very good and you're all very promising, but there are only 3 slots here, and we just have to do our best and get the one with the best fit.
Right. That's an important thing. You want to get someone who's a good fit for your program. They may be excellent in other regards, but if they're not the right fit for your program, they may not excel as much.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, we've had experiences with people quitting on us midstream.
Oh my goodness!
And we never, especially right after the pandemic. Okay. You know, there were some mental issues going on there, and some people were, you know, just giving up and then just quitting on us. So we've tried to become a little more selective, and but you can't predict it sometimes. Yeah. Fortunately, there's always somebody to take their place, because there's somebody waiting in the wings. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Even in my experience of more than 20 years at UCLA. Yeah, every so often there's a resident or a fellow who quits halfway through because of whatever personal reasons. It can certainly happen. But in your program, now, what's amazing is that, you're offering the full kind of spectrum here. So a lot of training programs will offer certainly cataract surgery, but may not get to the toric lens, presbyopic lens, EDOF lens, and kind of the refractive side of it, but you incorporate it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why it's called the Refractive Surgery and Advanced Cataract Fellowship.
What? That's fantastic. That's unusual, because most places it's hard to get that hands-on experience with those type of cases.
That's true. Well, I'm lucky enough that people approach me to do trials on their lenses, and so the fellow gets a lot of experience, you know, just preparing these patients and then eventually doing these cases with me. So, and I hope to keep it going like that. Because cataract is really what, as they say, our bread and butter, correct?
Oh, sure.
We have to be the best at it. because that's what we do all the time.
Right. I mean, if you look at all the Philippine Islands, I mean, the number one cause of vision issues is for sure cataract.
It's still cataract. Yeah. Yeah. And surprisingly, we're one of the few nations whose one of the leading causes of blindness is corneal blindness. And you won't be able to guess why. From measles in childhood.
Wow.
They get infected, and then they develop the scars, and they get corneal blindness. And it's a leading cause of blindness. It's very unique.
I don't think I've ever in my life seen a case of corneal scarring from measles.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah, because there's some, you know, some of the maybe traditional medicine, they put all sorts of stuff into the eyes, causing infections. And we see a lot, and that's another thing, you know, we do have a lot of corneal blindness, but our eye bank, no matter how much we try to rev it up, it's a very limited supply. It's much better than before, but still it doesn't seem to match the pace of at which we see these patients. So there's a pretty long waiting list for patients to be done.
For sure.
It used to be they would wait years, now they wait months.
But from a public health perspective, much, much harder to treat corneal blindness.
Oh, definitely.
And so much easier to treat cataract blindness.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. But there's also a problem there. I mean, sometimes we feel like the new graduates are just cataract surgeons. I mean, they forget about everything else, and they're just focusing on cataract. And our board of ophthalmology is trying very hard to, you know, to bolster the other subspecialties as well. But I would say 70% of all cases are cataract in the Philippines.
Right, right, for sure. I think that's probably even worldwide. It's about the same numbers.
True. Yeah, yeah, right.
So even on cataract, Coach, at least 70% of the videos are cataract. I have some glaucoma videos, some glaucoma videos, a few cornea videos, some refractive videos, but I mean, vast majority is cataract.
Yeah, well, it's also very exciting. I mean, it's a very interesting type of surgery. It's also a very rewarding, you know, like especially if you do a 5+ cataract, and the next morning they're practically kissing you because they can finally see. So yeah, it's a very rewarding type of surgery.
Oh, it's a miracle.
I mean,
the reason I went into ophthalmology for the first place is I saw a patient having white cataract surgery and went from blind to normal vision the next day.
The next day. And so that's what I saw when I saw my father doing it. I said, you know, this is really cool. I mean, they're blind one day, and the next day they can see, and they walk home by themselves. So it was very inspiring.
So what is needed then for the Philippines as a whole? You have a obviously important background in public health. You did your master's at Harvard. What is needed to help eradicate blindness then in the Philippines?
There's a load of things that should be done. And the problem is a lot of it, you know, should be borne by the government, except that the government has other problems to deal with, which are in their opinion is a lot more important. One thing is they should make finances available. I mean, the reason why doctors are all in the cities because that's where they earn their living. If you can't make them go out to a remote area, and they'll not be able to make enough to feed themselves and raise their children and educate them. So there must be a way wherein they can be compensated properly so that they can be enticed to stay there and actually live there. And if not, there should be some sort of program where the doctors can be sort of rotated over there, assigned there for a while, and then just so that it can be served. And then, you know, after a month, another group comes in and does. Also, they need to provide all the equipment. See? So I think a very good model is the one that I saw in Aravind. Have you been to Madurai?
Yeah, in Aravind. Tell us about your experience there.
Yeah. So the first year I was the first year that I was chair, we had an invitation to visit, and I was really interested because I had heard a lot about it. It was very eye-opening because they operate on some sort of hub and spoke system, wherein the central hospital has all the operating staff and all the advanced diagnostics. And what they have are remote clinics manned not by doctors, but actually by midwives and nurses with a slit lamp and a camera and a internet connection. And so they're trained to identify the cataract and some other simple eye disease. Send the pictures back to the hub, and then they say, okay, put them on the bus and bring them over. They have the surgery, and then they shuttle them back. And I think that's a model that the Philippines can try to emulate.
Sure.
Yeah, because it saves on a lot. You don't have to buy a lot of equipment. Your trained personnel, you know, you can manage to concentrate them in where they're needed most, and we can train paramedical people just to do the screening. I think it needs a more concerted effort, and hopefully it won't work unless the private sector helps out as well, because the government can't do it themselves.
Like in that system, the Aravind system, it's interesting that they have in the same building, one part of the building is for the private pay patients.
Yeah.
And then the other side of the building is for the charity patients. And the private pay patients are helping to subsidize the charity patients.
Yeah. So we in the Philippines, we sometimes call that the Robin Hood system.
Right.
Yeah. And what was also interesting in Aravind was that they make their own stuff. They took me to the factory where they make the IOLs, the sutures, even the eye drops. And I think that's really the way to go. If we're going to lick this problem, we're going to have to make our own stuff, because if we are just dependent on imports, it's going to be so expensive that we'll never get ahead.
Right. So, for example, like an IOL, in the Aravind system, they can make it for just a few US dollars for one IOL, for literally just a few dollars. Whereas if you import it, you're looking at like $100 US.
Exactly. So, in the Aravind system is a very, very good system. And I think it's something that we should study more closely. And I think those would work.
Yeah, I think those, and there are also some very talented surgeons.
You're
looking at, I mean, 100 cataracts per surgeon per day is the norm.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing. You know, the wife of Aravind, Haripriya, she was doing like 40 in a day. And she, you know, just before lunch, she'd spend like 6 minutes on a cataract. That's amazing skill.
Right.
And I actually invited them over, you know, after I got back from Aravind. I started this like a training program for doctors who had not learned phaco in their residency. We had a lot of that in the 2000s. And in my hospital, I would say maybe 60% of the doctors there were not comfortable doing phaco at all, because they didn't really learn it in residency. I didn't learn phaco in my residency. I taught myself how to do FACO.
Wow. But,
yeah. So I copied Aravind's style. So what they used to do was they had this program where they would teach them the basics. They would have modules where they would teach them the basics of incisions, rexes, and all the basic steps. And then it was in a two-week program, they would bring these doctors through. And at the end of that, they would be able to do cases with the experienced surgeons.
Oh.
And then we would be able to graduate them and let them loosen in their private practice. And we trained a good number of those doctors. And I'm very proud to say some of them are quite successful today because of that. So, and you know, that's one good thing we did. Yeah. And then it went on for maybe about 8-10 years, and then we finally were able to train most of these doctors, and we didn't have many applicants for the program, so we just quietly folded it up. But it was a good thing.
Now, how do you go about learning FACO? It seems such a huge leap to undertake on your own. So now, obviously, for residency, we have a very regimented training program to learn FACO.
And we have a cataract coach.
Of course. But you learned FACO, like, without any of those things.
No, I learned FACO in the late 90s and early 2000s. I watched a couple of videos. I remember Doug Cook's videos and several other renowned surgeons. And I just, you know, just bite the bullet and just go ahead and do it. You know, every time I would do surgery, I was really sweating and, you know, wouldn't be able to sleep the night before. But, you know, after you get over the hump, the learning curve, yeah, then it becomes much easier. But I learned the hard way, and I wouldn't do it again.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's much, much better to learn in your training program with a regimented method as opposed to just learning it on your own, which is much more challenging.
Yeah. The good part of that is that I can tell them, okay, that doesn't work. Okay, so let's do it this way. I've done it already. So I proved it doesn't work, so don't do that.
No, for sure. Now, when you have a resident in your program who's really incredibly talented, it's kind of easy. But sometimes you have some other residents who struggle a bit.
Yeah.
How do you help the residents who are struggling in the operating room? What advice do you have to help them?
Well, as long as it's not a physical problem, meaning to say they don't really have the talent, the hands for it, most of the problems, it's a mental issue with them. So at least in my experience, they're a little bit tense, they're very apprehensive, they're very they're not confident with what they're doing. They know the stuff, they know the steps, they know what to do, but it doesn't seem to translate into their actions. And so what we do with them is we just spend more time with them. I make sure that, you know, they know that I'm always there to, you know, to that they can fall back on. So I don't, and that's I think that's the major reason. And so far, I don't think we've ever graduated a resident who can't, you know, do it by himself and be fairly confident in doing surgery. Of course, there will be people who will be better than others, but at least they'll have made the minimum quality required. Right. Our board requires us to do about, I think, 50 cataracts, whether FACO or ECC or M6. Many of our residents, they exceed 100 cases, that's another reason why they eventually get better, just by plain repetition
volume.
Yeah.
You know, for sure. And then the beauty there is once they start practice in the Philippines, you have an unlimited supply of cataracts.
That's true. That's true. And a growing population. You know, right. We are one third the U.S. population. Okay. And we're only like, I think, oh, I don't know, 1/100th the land mass. So wow. We're a big, big, we're lots of Filipinos.
Well, yeah, there's obviously a huge need then for ophthalmology. And so, like you were saying, I think if the sometimes if the government can move towards what like they're doing in Brazil, mm-hmm. where you have the government paying a very modest amount for the public health system, but it's enough that the Brazilian surgeons now have become super efficient. They'll do part of their time in private practice, mm-hmm. and part of their time with the public health system. Mm-hmm. And the public health system, we've interviewed ophthalmologists who do 100 phacos in one day in one operating room in 8 hours. Yeah.
I can believe that. They do that in Vietnam as well.
Right, they become very efficient. So I think there needs to be some sort of incentive for these young ophthalmologists to go out there and just eradicate the problem.
Yeah. The problem really is if they can get the proper compensation for it.
Right.
Because you know, they all need a livelihood. They all need to bring up their kids and educate their kids. So they need to be, and they spent so much going through medical school. They need to get, you know, at least a living wage, something to, you know, not just be able to get by, but, you know, so that they can improve as well.
Yeah, that's obviously the challenge at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. That's a challenge. Now, you also started a dry eye clinic, which is a very, I think, probably the first in the Philippines. So especially yes. just for dry eyes. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, it's always been my interest, dry eye. And when I was a fellow in Boston, one of my mentors there was David Sullivan, who mm-hmm. actually started the TFOS, Tear Film Ocular Society. And so I got really interested in dry eye. And when we got back, I continued to study it. I used to research it a lot. They used to ask me to make lectures all the time. And when I had the chance, we were able to put together some equipment. And I had two fellows that we had trained in Cornea, and you know, I got them interested in. So we started this little clinic here, where not only would be treating, but we'd actually be researching, gathering all the data about, especially industrial dry eye. You know, we have a lot of back office, you know, like the call centers where there's a lot of dry eye. Yeah, so we had a lot of patients, and we were able to get some grants from the pharmaceuticals, and then we were able to start it. So it's still a work in progress. It's still the dry eye clinic is a squatter in the LASIK center where we house all of it. But just today, I was actually offered, you know, more equipment and some sort of grant. So. Hopefully, we'll be able to build on that.
Yeah, that's it's interesting because you may think that, okay, well, the Philippines is hot and humid. There shouldn't be so much dry eye. But again, all the air-conditioned spaces, we were indoors, they're very dry in there.
Yeah. And, you know, we have one of the largest populations of call center agents.
Right.
See, so that's everybody has dry eye in these call centers.
Right. So not only do they spend the whole day working in the call center, but in the evenings, if people don't know, the Philippines has the world's largest malls. you can't believe the scale of it. It's like the largest malls I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, they replaced the parks because it's too hot outside. So they go in the malls and they stroll around the malls because it's air conditioned.
Right. But again, air conditioning causes basically you dehumidify it, you make it drier.
Yeah, that's right. That's
right. So that's an issue there. Wow. Now, you also had, I was very fortunate to be invited to speak at your meeting. You have an annual seminar for the Eye and Vision Institute. How did you start this? Like, I think like 17, 18 years ago. How did you start all this?
Oh, well, it was an, we were a fairly new department.
Okay.
And we became an institute only about 6 years ago. But from the start, I wanted something that would, you know, maybe announce to the world that we're here and that we're, you know, we're of value. So I said, maybe let's hold a scientific meeting every year and then show the world the best of what we can do. So from the start, we always insisted that all the lecturers were from our hospital. We hardly invited any outside lecturers in the early years. And the goal was really to say that, you know, this hospital is something to listen to, that we have something to share, we have something to say. And we were able to get a lot of support from the administration as well as from industry. And so it became very popular. We usually just concentrated on the interesting stuff, usually cataract. And so everybody, as long as it's cataract, people will come in and watch
it.
That's why you're so popular.
I think we all love cataracts.
Yes, we do. And so even if you're a retina surgeon or a pediatric surgeon or a neuro-ophthalmologist, you still do cataract in the Philippines. So we got known to be you know, a place where you can get nice lectures and hear the newest stuff. And, you know, even during pandemic, when everything was closed, we organized YouTube like a podcast.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and we produced 19 shows during the pandemic years. Different topics, but a lot of it cataract as well. Yeah.
Well, if you send me the link, I'm happy to put the link down below in our description so our listeners and viewers can go and watch those videos too, for sure.
Sure. They're all on YouTube.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the world loves YouTube, I'm telling you. that we know for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I saw that, well, obviously I really enjoyed the meeting as well. And when I was there, you had three international speakers. You had me, Ben Lahoud from Australia, and Ron Yeo from Singapore, all great lectures. But what I liked the most was your young faculty and your young residents and fellows who presented cases, which were spectacular cases, very difficult, very challenging, and just beautifully executed.
Oh, yeah. Well, we wanted to show the best, and that's what we aim for. And of course, you know, since Cataract Coach was there, you know, you want to show off a little bit.
No, those cases were really fantastic. I mean, it's it was a pleasure to learn from them. But I also really like the enthusiasm from your young doctors that you're training, your residents, your fellows. Really a high-level enthusiasm. It was just a fantastic time.
You know, ophthalmology is one of the most popular specialties in the Philippines. And in the hospital, we're the ideal. I mean, people are very envious of us because we have no lack for applicants for our residency program. And it's because the work is it's fun, actually. You know, it's not very tiring, as you should know. It can be stressful as well, but you know, it's not like you were in surgery or waiting for like an obstetrician waiting for a delivery. It's nothing like that, right? I mean, it's almost like a 9-to-5 job, and after that you can party or you can have fun after that. So the lifestyle of an ophthalmologist, at least the reputation of ophthalmologists in the Philippines, is you know, you're cool. it's a cool specialty. And so the personality of the people who apply and become residents are, you know, of the same vein. And you see people like that, very animated, very lively. They work hard, but they party hard.
So, for sure.
Yeah.
I stayed late at the party. I even participated in the karaoke, but I was so terrible at singing. I hope no one videoed it. Please, if you have the video of me doing karaoke, please delete it. Do not post it online.
But they remember you.
Wait a second. I had a fantastic time. And I think that meeting has grown. The meeting has grown more and more every year. It was huge. The room was absolutely full.
Yeah, we had more than 300. We had more, and that's not counting those who were not registered, like the industry people who were there, right, and a few of the staff from the institute who just came over to watch. So we had more than 300 people there.
Yeah, a lot of ophthalmologists. It was actually a great discussion, too. I liked the format, and I also loved how you had the young doctors hosting it and kind of emceeing it, and they were absolutely on time.
Which
is hard to do.
Well, I was amazed myself because I didn't think it was they would have it in them, but they did it. They pulled it off.
You know, every time I see young ophthalmologists, I always think, I'm so lucky that I did my training many decades ago, because if I had to compete now, there's no way I can compete with these guys. They're so amazing.
That's right. Especially in the grades.
And everything. It's unbelievable now. But if I had to apply for ophthalmology now, I'd probably end up doing primary care. I couldn't match even in ophthalmology.
Me as well. Because in med school, I didn't really care about the other stuff. I just made sure I got an A in ophthalmology. That's it.
Yeah, so it's a really neat time. It's amazing how far, obviously, ophthalmology's come. Amazing how far your program has come from just one little room to now a whole institute. And now so many residents and fellows. I mean, you're making a permanent impact. It's just sometimes we don't, when we're young, we don't realize just how much we can actually achieve.
Yeah, well, we're still doing it. So I'm not about to retire yet. So. Looking back yet.
Well, you're still growing it. No, but it's kind of important to know where you came from, and then obviously to know where you're going. If I was going to guess, I think you're going to keep growing it even bigger.
Oh yeah, that's the aim. That's the aim. As I said, we want to populate the branch hospitals with all our graduates.
Right. You can do a hub and spoke model. Same thing.
Yeah. Exactly. That's what I had in mind. We'll get Aravind to inaugurate the whole thing again.
Yeah, I think that model really can work across the globe. But again, there are big challenges, like you said. You've got to do your own manufacturing. There's a lot of challenges, but...
Yeah. But you just have to start somewhere, you know. And fortunately, there are many people who are interested in helping and providing expertise and financial backing. I think we just need a more concerted effort. You know, I mean, we have a national program for the prevention of blindness. There is it's policy in the government. The problem is, there's no budget for it. And it's sort of embedded in what we call our universal healthcare. So there's no actual implementation going on, but it's there. There's a policy for the prevention of blindness. So we just have to act on it.
You should have a tourist tax for all the millions of tourists who visit the Philippines. check here to donate, you know, a modest amount to help eradicate blindness.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, remember in Spain, they They have a society for the blindness there, which is financed by the public lottery.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and we have something like that in the Philippines, and maybe we should tap them as well. Yeah.
Right. Or I was thinking tourist stuff, because when I visit, obviously as a tourist, first it's unbelievable beauty. The islands there, I don't think I've seen a prettier island. I mean, the white sand, like Boracay, the white sand, the sand is like powder, and
Oh, yeah.
the water is like turquoise blue. It's unbelievable beauty.
Yeah, it's probably the best beach for the sand. But there are places in Palawan that are just as pretty. Yeah, come
Yeah,
back.
for sure.
We'll visit all of them.
I had a fantastic time, I'm telling you. Because after your meeting, like I said, I spent a few days visiting Boracay and then El Nido and Palawan. It
Yeah.
was just spectacular.
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah, there are many other places.
Yeah, I get 7,700 more islands to
Yeah.
visit. I won't run out of places to go.
Yeah, you won't run out.
What I should do is next time I should come and go travel with another Filipino surgeon, and we can go spend the morning doing surgery and then the
Right.
afternoons and evenings enjoying.
Yeah. You have the right idea. Yeah, you do a mission.
Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah,
I spent
that's good. That you come back, we'll organize
yeah, so in the
it.
morning doing really tough cases,
Yeah.
and then the afternoon enjoying the beaches, and then the evening having a nice dinner.
Yep. And karaoke.
Oh, there is one problem. I have one problem with the Philippines, though. After my trip, I think I gained 2 or 3 kilos. The Filipino food was so good. I can eat that lechon barbecue every day. I can eat that every day. It's just so delicious. It was
You
unbelievable.
like the lechon. Do you know that lechon it's actually like it used to be like a ritual food for Filipinos. I
I didn't
mean,
know.
now they think it of it like as a celebratory, like a party food, right?
Right.
But before it was like a ritual food because it would differentiate the Christians from Jews and Muslims who don't eat pork. So if you ate pork, you're Christian. And we were colonized by Spain, and we were a Christian nation because of that. And that's why they sort of encouraged the eating of pork. See, so that's the little story I have about lechon there.
I did not realize, but yeah, the food was just the food was delicious.
It's really good.
Yeah, the other one I love too is the chicken adobo.
Oh,
Whatever
yeah.
spices were in there, the spices were just like probably the tastiest chicken I've ever had.
Yeah. You like the vinegar taste, huh?
You get the sourness in it. Yeah, it was
Yeah,
just
yeah,
it was.
yeah.
Anyway, I had an amazing time. Looking forward to coming back. Victor, I want to
Oh.
thank you for taking the time. We've been talking for almost an hour now. I can't believe it.
Yeah, time
Time
flies.
flies. Yeah, when we're having fun.
Yes, we
You've done
are.
amazing. You've done amazing things there. Amazing to start with such a small idea in one room and grow to such a big institute, and now with sights on the future to grow to even more. I'm impressed. It really is amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank
And
you.
I encourage our listeners, if you're ever in the Philippines, please look up Victor, visit
Oh,
him,
yeah.
visit the Eye Institute. You will love it. And then again, enjoy the best of the Philippines. It's an amazing place to visit.
Oh, we'd love to have them. Yeah, just send them over.
For sure. And then if you send me the links later, we'll put them down below in our description. If you have the
Sure.
links for your whatever you have, your YouTube channel, we're happy to feature that. And again, I want to
Okay.
thank you for taking the time with talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. It was a lot of fun today.
Thank you, Victor. And I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single week on Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google. Everywhere you find your podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. We also now have a Retina Rounds podcast every week. Plus, of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day. 2,700 videos and counting. So until next time, I'll catch you later.